once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another really exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, first in 2014, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we start off today with a delay, like we weren't here, because we were somewhere else. We were actually sitting in the I-35 parking lot, and when we finally got to the place where traffic started speeding up again, we could see absolutely no evidence of why we had been sitting almost stationary for the previous 20 minutes or so. So that is the strange event on I-35 these days. But you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Personal Wealth Coach is a couple of things, not by coincidence. We are both an SEC-registered investment advisory firm, and we're also a radio program. See? So we have... It's one of those things of where I'm schizophrenic.
So am I.
And we kind of have these dual identities. Actually, we have additional identities, but they're secret, so we're not going to let you know
right.
who they are.
Right. We can't... if we did, it wouldn't be secret anymore.
And we would cease to be a mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper if we already were.
Giving it away, Clark. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, okay. Anyway, you can give us a call in here if today happens to be January 4th, Saturday. Well, it's going to be a Saturday in all likelihood, if you're listening to this on the radio. And you can. And by the way, we do have podcasts at our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. But you can give us a call in here if today is Saturday, the 4th of January, 2014, the first Personal Wealth Coach program this year. Boy, that's kind of a redundant all over again thing. 773-1400, area code 254-773-1400 if you're in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400. We're experiencing some technical stuff on this thing, too, in that I think you're... headset and my headset is only coming through in one ear.
Yes, and it's a little confusing. Well, it's because of the ultra-modern, cutting-edge 1950s technology in here.
Yes.
Matter of fact, it's a bleeding-edge 1950s technology,
right,
probably.
Is that a letter from the Smithsonian asking?
Well, you know, I did this control panel in here is probably qualified for an archaeological dig. But that's beside the point. You know, the fact that we have to use flint tools to work on it is a giveaway.
Could
know?
Be.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, you're welcome to give us a call. Again, the telephone number's in the 254 area code. If you're on a cell phone or something, you're certainly welcome to call 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And you probably already figured this out, but last year, 2013, the stock market in the United States did fairly well.
Yeah. I figured that one out.
Really?
I was able to see that, yes, indeed, the stock market did fairly well.
Through Friday, if we look back 1 year, and I realize that's not the true end-of-year numbers. I know that in advance. Dow Jones Industrial Average was up about 22.5%. The S&P 500 was up about 25%. I realize these are maybe a little different from some of the numbers you've heard in other places. And by the way, one of the things I noticed in looking for the total return of the various indices that are out there is different sites would give me different numbers, and it all depends on how they count it, which just tells you a lot about indexes. The NASDAQ should outperform. It did. 33.22%. It was up. So we just had a really, really, really good year, and probably the key thing about the end of the year is that for the first, 2013 ended in real terms with the major market indices, the S&P 500 and the Dow, above where they were at the end of 2000. And this is the first time after
inflation, yeah.
After we figure in inflation, this is the first time that those indices have been above where they were in 2000. So if you invested probably in about a 3 or 4 year period there, beginning maybe in 1998 through probably 2001. Up until the end of this year, after inflation, odds are you had a loss in your portfolio. And very few people realize that because very few people look that far back. The question wasn't, did you have a loss? The question was, how much of a loss did you have? Most people believe they outperformed the market during that period. We look at the real numbers, and we have found, unfortunately, that many people haven't. We were really, really pleased to see those numbers turn positive last year in real terms. And there's some good news associated with that. The longer and more severe the downturn in the stock market, in the U.S., we're talking about the U.S. equity market as measured by the Dow Jones Industrial Average or S&P 500. The longer and more severe the downturn, historically, the better the performance is over a like period following. Meaning, we had 14 years of bad market. We had 14 years, I say bad market, we had 14 years during which the major market indexes or indices in the United States did not show a gain after inflation. Which means that history suggests that the next 14 years will be exceptionally good returns in the market. That's just, it's kind of like floods and droughts. It's called reversion to the mean. We have a caller on 866-597-1400, and I think we probably ought to put that caller on the air.
That sounds like a good idea.
You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. My name is Susan from Georgetown, and I really appreciate your show, especially the macroeconomics when you talk about global issues and things like that, mm-hmm. information I don't get anyplace else. And just as an individual investor, a couple, I'd like to hear your strategy for spending in retirement related to RMDs, when you have to take RMDs, types of investing you might do with that money, in addition to, you know, charitable giving and such. Bond fund dividends, if you have some of those, like, outside an IRA.
Yes, I need to get a pen here.
No, I got the picture here. Yeah.
I didn't know how much detail you needed.
Well, I'll
hang up and listen,
okay.
And thank you for your thoughts.
Well, thank you very much for calling. That means that we have at least one person listening out there.
Not anymore.
Well, but she said she was going to listen.
We only had proof
she
for
promised,
a moment.
But she promised she would listen.
Okay. All right.
I'm going to start on this one, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm going to start, rather than addressing all the specifics that you gave, I am, just let you folks know out there, I'm on the 14th, I start my thesis and a master's program in personal financial planning. And actually, a couple of the courses I took in the master's program were exactly on this subject. So I actually feel like I know what I'm talking about for a difference, for an unusual event here. You wouldn't believe how often people ask me a question and I have to say, I really don't know the answer to that one. The spending in retirement is, according to all the studies that have been published, and I mean literally all of them, very, very different from what financial planners like myself over the last 30 years thought we were going to see. And it's very, very different from what people who were planning for their financial future thought they were going to see. And this is the interesting thing. It's very, very different from what the previous generation did when they retired. It is a prime example of past performance is no guarantee of future return. I'll tell you that. Because what we've discovered about people in retirement is, first off, they do not raise their income levels as fast as the consumer price index goes up.
In fact, we've found in many cases that people in retirement after the first few years actually lower the spending
right.
that they're doing. So their income goes down because they're not doing the same.
Well, not that their income goes down, their expenditures go down.
Right, their expenditures go down. So they take less income from a
right.
portfolio.
And so, of course, that you would say, oh, well, that's really, really good. Well, it's good, except for the fact that one of the errors that financial planners made, an error that a lot of people made, was keeping the portfolio aimed at a rate of return that was higher than was necessary. which meant that, for instance, in 2000, when downturns occur, they would be more severe when they hit that portfolio because the portfolio was more aggressive. The other thing that was sort of surprising is the degree to which, and you mentioned this, caller, the degree to which people in retirement, when they try to build their own portfolios, rely upon practices that they have heard by word of mouth or read in articles, worked for other people in the past, but which economically were something approaching suicide in the present. And by the way, if you live in Georgetown and you go to, and you live, if you're in Sun City or someplace and you go to the Super HEB or something around there, look who's bagging groceries. And a lot of the people who are bagging groceries aren't high school students there. It's people who live in Sun City. And one of the big questions, of course, is why are they now bagging groceries? If you ask them, it's because they wanted something to do with their time. Sure, I want to stand up for 8 hours and bag somebody else's groceries when I'm 65 years old. No, thank you. The fact is that they made some strategic errors, and Jake wants to say something about
that. Yeah, real quick. I was just going to give an example of one of the things that word of mouth says to do that is almost always a bad thing to do at this particular moment. And that is basically as you get older and get closer to retirement, you're shifting more and more of your portfolio to bonds. There's some pretty big dangers associated with that, in that bonds are being shifted to, in many cases, to avoid risk. The problem with that is that bonds right now are quite risky. There are certain bonds that are quite safe, but many bonds, because of our rising interest rate environment, are quite risky. To go to the thing that is likely to, I mean, it is a known quantity that we're going to have bond prices dropping as interest rates go up, and to go there with the expectation of being conservative is a little bit scary. One of the things that we say pretty clearly here is there's this kind of rule of thumb, and we say don't listen to it. There's a rule of thumb that says as you get older, as your age is 60, you need to be 60% in bonds and 40% in stocks. Well, we say that's not right. It needs to be developed based on who you are, not what age you are. Because think of all the other people your age that are completely different from you. It needs to be based on who you are and what your expectations are. I'm handing it back to you.
Let me give you an example on that. Last year, the Standard Poor's 500 was up a bunch, which is a technical term that we use in finance. But it was up somewhere above 20%. And by the way, I'm not advocating investing in the S&P 500, obviously, but that's I want to state that. Meanwhile, and that's considered the risk side of the for many people. Meanwhile, the used to be called the Lehman Brothers Aggregate Bond Index, but now it's called something else. Barclays, yeah, I think it's Barclays Aggregate Bond Index, which is called the AG, was down about 5% last year. Now, no matter what yield you had on the bonds as far as dividends coming in, you lost money last year if you were in bonds. The municipals, which are a very popular area for many retirees to go into, municipal bonds declined pretty much across the board, and they're continuing to decline. And this is without even having interest rates go up, they're declining. And there's some good reasons for all of those, and they're good economic reasons. So if a person at the beginning of last year was concerned, and a lot of people were concerned last year, that we were going to see another market collapse, which, by the way, at the beginning of last year was an extremely unlikely event. If you do economic fundamentals, you could see that. But still, people were very much afraid of it. And by going on word of mouth, retirees were pouring money at the beginning of last year into bonds, into municipal bonds, so they wound up pouring money into a section, an asset class that lost money. Now,
it's an asset class that not only lost money, if they'd done some research, just a little bit of research, they would have seen that it was likely to lose money.
Well, The problem is, how do they do research? This is my issue. If you went, for example, gold lost 28% last year.
Yep.
But at the beginning of last year, had you Googled gold rise or fall?
Everybody was going to say, oh, Google's going to go up. Word of mouth.
No, I actually not Google. I mean gold. Did I say Google?
You said gold, but gold. Then if you'd Googled word of...
Okay.
If you Googled it, it's going to look like everybody's saying gold is going
right.
to go up.
And so if you'd researched it very carefully, you'd conclude gold was going to go up unless you had some knowledge of economics. And we, at that point last year, this point last year, I think you and I, Jake, were about the sole people who were saying...
Gold's a problem child right now.
Yeah, and it's due for another... There's a consensus out there.
Pretty good drop, still ready to go for it.
It's probably the consensus that I read this morning in Barron's of people who really do honestly know what they're doing, in my opinion.
Not gold sellers.
The people who've been consistently right in their forecasts are saying gold will be down another 15% this year on top of the 28% it was down last year. And the big rush to sell gold by the public has not occurred yet.
Yeah,
so when
it's
that happens,
happen.
When people suddenly realize that they're in something that could drop a lot more, they're going to so the key in retirement, there's two big things I wanted to say about retirement. One, the spending patterns are probably going to be different than you think.
Yeah.
Two, the investments in retirement, and this is a shocker, this runs against every newspaper article and everything else I read, doesn't run against the actual studies. The day you retire or the day you retire or a month or 2 years before you retire versus a month or 2 years after you retire is your portfolio should be absolutely consistent.
Yeah.
You don't make changes in your portfolio because you're closing in on retirement.
You make your portfolio based on your life, not based on your retirement. If you convert your portfolio at retirement to something that doesn't have the potential to grow, unless you have a very, very large portfolio, and we're familiar with some people that whose portfolios are go to the very best of municipal bonds and not have a worry about those particular municipal bonds
failing.
But they'll
still lose money.
Right. And basically what you're talking about in these cases is, you know, long term, if that maturity value is paid, they haven't lost any money. They're not planning on selling them during that time. That's not most people. Most people need their portfolio to keep up with their income draw. They need their portfolio to keep up with inflation and their income draw. And in some cases, they need quite as much as full inflation. That says that you want to go completely into one asset class at retirement. She also mentioned RMDs.
Yeah, RMDs, early years, if you're actually drawing income from your retirement portfolio, are insignificant because they're going to be less than the money you're drawing. As you get older, your RMDs are going to rise. And
let me say what RMDs are. There's a lot of people out there. RMDs, is that a new kind of convertible? It's a Porsche.
They're no. RMs.
Required minimum distributions. The U.S. government wants its taxes. And if you've been putting money into a 401k or 403b or IRA or any of those other acronyms, the U.S. government hasn't been paid their taxes on that money yet. And what they want at your age 70 and a half is for you to start taking money out so they can start getting their money out.
Mm-hmm.
It's the U.S. government retirement program.
It's based on the amount of money you have to take out is based on table I or Roman numeral 1. Nobody can seem to make up
I don't
their
know if it's
difference.
I or 1.
It
I
looks,
don't know.
It's
is it a Latin 1 or
it's
an English
it's a
I?
It's a vertical bar, and then there's two vertical bars, and there's three vertical bars. And it's in publication 590, which IRS publication 590, which tells you how many years you have left to live.
Right. And 590. No.
Which is interesting because as you get a year older, a life expectancy table that the IRS uses that tells you that the amount of money you have to take out, and it's called a divisor, and you divide that number into the balance of all of your qualified retirement accounts. Qualified retirement accounts includes IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, anything that's qualified under
ERISA.
ERISA, which is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. Isn't that a mess? Anyway,
yeah.
The problem is that the older you get,
the more you have to take.
The bigger percentage of your total portfolio you have to take out.
And because the tables say that you're more likely to die soon, and they
right.
want to get as much of the taxes out
and
as they can get.
It's important that you set up a withdrawal rate that is sustainable, because here's the interesting thing. The IRS table is based on 1980 mortality rates, which are based on people that died
a long time ago,
which means they're too conservative. Secondly, if you have RMDs and they're significant, you will probably outlive the average person in the United States, because the more money you have, on average, the more money you have, the longer you live.
Right. This
so
has to do with
literally
planning.
RMD yourself. If you spend or give away all the money you take out from your RMDs, once they get higher than the amount of money you need, odds are you'll run out of money before you die. So
yeah.
it's important.
Life expectancy yeah. tables are, this is one of those silly things. It is based on average life expectancy, which means that by, for instance, age 82, half of the people of your peer group would be dead at age 82. Therefore, your life expectancy is 82 years old. That doesn't work for you. If you're used to planning for money, it's likely that you're planning on health and you're planning on remaining healthy and eating well. And all planning has a lot to do with success, whether it's monetary or health or anything else. If you're going ahead with that, then using those tables and saying, well, the IRS knows when I'm going to die, so I should take these RMDs, and they don't have a clue.
Well, actually, people I don't think that way. I think what they do is simply say it's an RMD. I've got to take it. Therefore, I need to spend it or I need to give it away.
Right.
Actually, I think it's more important that you set an amount of money that you want to get each month, you take it out. If your RMD is higher than that, if you're required during the year to take out more money than that, take it out at the end of the year. You obviously are going to have to pay your taxes on it. Take the amount of money that you didn't need and put it into an investment account. And there's different kinds of investment. But again, well-diversified, properly allocated investment account. And there's several very good reasons for that. And people have said to me, well, shouldn't I take that out and give it to a charity or something? Well, it all depends on whether you need that money. I mean, if you don't need that money and you don't want to pass it on to your heirs and you just flat don't need it and you want to give it away, well, then give it away. But don't let the RMD force you to give it away at a given rate.
Right. Don't let the government dictate to you how you spend your money. You need to determine for yourself what are your needs and what are your expectations for yourself on living. And the way we manage money, this is something we include in all of our statements, all of our talking to clients, is that we're not trying to manage a portfolio to have $0 left when you die. We're trying to manage a portfolio so that we actually have money when you die, so that if you're trying to continue to eat and you live longer than we expected, you continue to be able to do so.
One of the things that I think is a very telling statistic is that it was 2012 is the last year we have good data for. And in 2012, we had a record number of people, now listen carefully, discharged from hospice programs.
Whoops.
They went into a hospice program, which
and this is the good kind of discharge.
And
they went out walking, not feet first.
They got better. And a hospice program is only authorized for people who are about to die or clearly going to die in the near future. They go into a palliative care hospice program. It can only last for 6 months. At least it will only be paid for by Medicare for 6 months. And at the end of Medicaid, and at the end of the six-month period, if they are still alive, they're discharged, and they sometimes encounter some medical expenses they didn't anticipate at that point. In other words, medical science is getting better. People are living longer. And we, by the way, for whatever it's worth, generally make the assumption in a couple, and hang on to your seats here, that one of them will live past 100. Now, you may laugh at that, but the fact is, and I've actually talked to some life insurance actuaries whose who are working in companies where their profitability depends on getting this right, they assume a life expectancy well past 100 for a couple today on average. And we aren't thinking about that. We're thinking about, well, and this is what I hear many times from our clients, my parents and my grandparents all died before 80, therefore I will die before 80. And I can't tell you the number of people.
Think a moment for your grandparents, what age they died. If they died before 80 and you're in your 40s, then you're talking about 20 or 30 years ago that they died.
Right. Well, these are people in their 60s who normally say this.
Right. So now you're talking about 40 or 50 years before that somebody died. Do you think that over the last 40 or 50 years that medical science may have progressed just a little bit, that the medicines that you're taking today might be a little bit different than what your grandparents were taking? I have a one of the gifts that was given to me for Christmas this year was a 1939 quick reference book for nurses. So I flipped through to the beginning, and it talks about all of the quick reference, the very first quick reference. It's on the inside cover, is common ailments. There were mumps, there was measles, there was whooping cough, there was smallpox. They were still worried about smallpox.
Yeah.
Okay, so these are the quick reference. And then you flip back to the back, and it talks about poisons. What happens if you have different poisons? And their poison treatment was mostly drink lots of water and castor oil. That's it. That's your, you have heavy metal poisoning here, drink some castor oil. So think, that level of technology in medicine meant that your grandparents lived into their 60s and 70s. To live a little longer.
Well, I realize that we complained a lot about the medical system, but I'm just telling you that we're seeing phenomenal increases in life expectancy. And like I said, over 100 is for a couple. Now, one of them might die. But when we build a portfolio, it's for a couple. So plan on living to 105. And that's, and I hate to say it this way, because I use 105 because that's about as far as people's minds will go. It could go a lot longer than that. You know, if you're in your 60s today, let's say you're 60 years old today, 105 is 45 years away. And if you look at the advances in medical science over the last 45 years.
Yeah, and then apply that to the future, only we're getting faster at it. We're getting better at getting new technology. And we've been doing this since, if you go back to Stone Age, how long did it take us to make some stone tools? Well, it's really hard to tell. A long time.
Well, the stopwatches weren't as accurate.
Right.
Back then.
So we're thinking somewhere around 100,000 years to go from shaking limbs to get fruit to fall down to, oh, we've got some stone tools. Now we can carve things. And then it took 10,000 years to figure out how to use an addle, which is a stick that you use to throw other sticks. It's very difficult, but it took us 10,000 years.
Addle. I got to remember. That's a good term. I like
yes,
that. Can we use that instead of stuff?
Yes, stuff. We'll just use addle.
Well, there was a great deal of addle in the market today.
Right. It's good stuff.
And people will think we're really intelligent.
Yes, and they'll go, I don't know. I've never heard of that.
That's a stick used to throw a stick.
Yes, right? It's a stick used to throw a stick. It's a little stick with a cup on the end. Okay. The wheel comes along. How long did it take us to develop a round thing that turns? It was a long time, but it revolutionized things. Egypt went and conquered huge areas of Africa because they had a wheel on which they had some cloth and leather so that they could ride around behind a horse.
But fascinatingly enough, they didn't have any wagons.
Right. Wagons came along. The Romans developed the wagons because they had roads and they could make heavier things. So this is now we're talking another 1,000 years. Then the stirrup comes along 1,000 years after that.
But
we're picking up.
Then the horse collar.
The horse collar comes
so
within a couple of hundred years.
These things with something other than
right.
An ox.
So we got stirrups and horse collars, and then you start getting faster. We start figuring out three-field rotation. We start figuring out that we can grow more things and that we can start breeding animals to get healthier and bigger and stronger. And as time goes on, we went from the wagon to the car, from the car to the airplane in a very short period of time. We go from the airplane. Now what's next? We don't know. But technology is increasing at an exponential rate. It is not increasing at that geometric rate that we saw. It's getting faster and faster. So if you look back at the last 45 years of medical development, and then you look forward at what we expect the next 45 years to be, targeted DNA treatments, they've just developed a serum that they're giving to rats that are making the rats live three times as long as they did before.
And these
are old rats.
This is a really serious problem. If you have a rat infestation.
Yes. If the rats in your house ever get a hold of this stuff, forget about it. It's done. You know, you're just hand over the deed, say, here you go, rats. You can have the house. It's
right.
All over. I don't know why they're these scientists, they're problems.
Why are they trying to make rats live longer?
They found a correlation in cancer in rats, by the way.
It's
100% correlation. It is 100% in all measurable cases of cancer in rats.
They're all breathing.
They all have scientists around them. So stay away from scientists.
Right, that makes sense. Okay. Particularly laboratory research scientists that work on rats.
Yes. Stay away from them. They have in California been shown to cause cancer in rats.
Right.
Scientists.
Right. That makes perfectly
dangerous
good sense.
Stuff.
Right.
Those people are weird.
You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone numbers to call in here 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
So I hope we answered that question there. The other thing I want to say is there's a key element here, and that is that for the last 30 years, roughly, interest rates have been coming down. Now, there's some exceptions in there, a short period of times when they bumped up, but basically starting in the 1980s, interest rates started down. During that entire period, that meant if you bought a bond on the secondary market, there's a pretty high probability, or a bond fund, there's a pretty high probability that you would see the principal value rise even as you received interest from the account.
Right.
That is, I won't say it's a certainty, but it's a very, 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 very strong probability, which is all we have to work with about the future, that over the next 30 years, certainly over the next 15 years, I say certainly, even a higher probability over the next 10 to 15 years, we'll see that reverse. We'll see interest rates rising, which means that a given bond or a bond portfolio or a bond mutual fund will probably see a decreasing principal value even as the interest rates are being paid out, so that you're actually getting your principal paid back to you and paying full, in many cases, paying full taxes on it.
I'm going to mention two things here. This is macro, very macroeconomic. First, the Fed is easing, it's tapering back on QE3. So it's...
Man, you had, that was a mouthful. I'm really impressed with what you just said.
What? It's easing?
The Fed is easing and tapering back its...
QE3, which is easing. So it's easing the easing.
Quantitative easing on QE3. I was impressed.
Well, I think we should have an agenda to discuss the agenda of whether or not the easing on the easing is taking place.
Yeah, we're easing the easing.
Right. So the Fed is tapering. It is stopping its purchasing at the same levels. It's gone from $85 billion to $75 billion of mortgage-backed securities and U.S. Treasury bonds. However, in 10 years, if we have a rising interest rate environment, when we're talking about 2024, the Congressional Budget Office has said that if we have a relatively slow rising interest rate, we're talking about debt on the interest on our debt in 10 years being large enough that it's close to our discretionary spending. So that's what Congress argues about all the time, about where that discretionary spending is. So there's a problem there. That means that the Fed can't get completely out of this. They have to work to keep this down. Secondly, as they're easing.
Right.
As they're tapering the amount of money that they're using, other people are stepping in and buying a lot more than what the easing is happening. Abenomics, we're talking about Japan, has said that they expect to buy between $200 and $240 billion of U.S. government securities over the next 10 years. I'm sorry, not 10 years, year.
Okay.
Jumping
to say that, yeah.
That's not very much over the next 10 years. It's over the next year. That is more than what the Federal Reserve is saying they're tapering at this point.
Yeah, at this point, right.
And now they'll taper more as it goes on.
I think they'll have QE3 shut down by the end of 2014.
Now, it sounds like, just from the surface of it, that the Japanese are really dumb. Because
no.
If we're talking about raising interest rate environment and they want to buy a whole bunch of U.S. government bonds, don't you think the principal value of that is going to be going down with the interest payments and so on and so forth? If you were an American citizen, that would be a pretty silly thing to do. However, the yen's value against the dollar has been dropping. So where I would expect the value of a U.S. bond to drop about 3% over the next 3 years, if the yen value, the value that they're buying it with, is dropping faster, and it is, than the dollar, we're talking about a 7% gain in yens to the Japanese.
I actually think the value of a long-term treasury security may drop more than that. But
right, in which case they...
Because they were more than that they dropped more than that this year.
Correct.
But the point is that there's a very good reason they're buying that. If money flows out of Japan to the United States, we're talking about big money here, the yen declines in value and the dollar rises. And for the Japanese, who have an export-driven economy, that's good news. That means that the companies in Japan that manufacture things in Japan and export them to the United States, first off, can now sell them for a larger dollar amount. But in the sense that their yen is less, the dollar is more, they make a bigger profit.
It means it's cheaper when we buy that thing.
Yeah.
Coming to us
from Japan.
From Japan, okay, it's a less expensive product. We're going to buy more of it.
But there's a bigger reason that they would rather see, they'd like to see the yen come down in value.
Uh-huh.
And that is, they're in competition with us as exporters now.
Yep.
It's no longer a two-way street. It's about a 20-way street. One of the big things...
try to design the traffic for that.
That's what the world is doing. That's why we have oceans. One of the big issues is there's a big competition now between the United States and China, a very healthy competition, still a big one, over Mexico.
Yep.
The Chinese, by the way, Mexico is one of our largest customers for exports.
Yeah. Well, the two largest trading partners of the United States, people are always shocked when I tell them this, the two countries in the world, number one country that we trade the most with. Export and import, either one of them, where they're in the top of the list, Canada. People go, really? Mm. Yep. Canada's our number one trading partner. Number two, Mexico, both import and export. Mexico's our number two trading partner. So go ahead.
So the Chinese are very, very interested in cranking their export economy back up, which, by the way, has been failing.
Yes, they have a balance of trade deficit at this point. They are net importers.
And they're trying really hard to do what they can to get more money flowing into or get the Mexicans to buy more stuff from them. And that leads me to...
And the Africans.
Right. Well, mostly they're buying from the Africans. Africa is pretty unstable.
They're trying to get raw products.
Which reminds me, there's a very good article that I read...
Do we have more commercials?
I think he ran all the commercials.
No, he said there was one more section.
There is?
Yeah.
Well.
Okay.
Jeff can't find it.
Never mind then. Okay. Well, anyway, you said one more thing.
If there's another section, okay, 7, 8. Oh, okay. Maybe there is. 10. Yeah. 10. Okay.
We do have commercials to play.
All right, we're going to play some more commercials. We'll come back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake.
McClure, and we have managed to finish our commercials for this first hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, and we have about a minute left in the program.
In this hour of the program.
Got a lot more to discuss with you. I want to discuss an article that George Soros just published, which I think was astonishingly accurate and on track next hour. We'll discuss that about where the economy is going and what the threats are to the world economy and what the benefits are to the world economy from various things. For better or worse, whether you like George Soros or don't like George Soros, it's one of those deals where if you're so smart, why ain't you rich? Well, he is because he is.
Very. And one of the things about George Soros, we're not big fans of his, but we do recognize his intelligence. He's done some things that have made himself a lot of money. It's generally at the expense of somebody else, where we like to make money where everybody makes money. But it's good to hear his perspective on things, as long as he's being honest.
And you have been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach for the last hour. We've got another hour today. This is Saturday, January 4th. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, leave a message for us. Of course, during the week, we have live people answering the phone, but you can give us a call. We have a voicemail waiting at 254-947-1111. Or
you can reach that same voicemail and during the week live voice at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can also email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, to listen to podcasts. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
True. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.